In what had served as the archive room for Limerge Power's plasma facility, droid parts were piling up so fast and so high that Obi-Wan and Anakin could scarcely see Dooku's wavering holo image any longer. The business of destroying infantry droids, for that's precisely what the confrontation had come down to, was beginning to take a toll on Obi-Wan. But for every droid either of them destroyed, five more would appear, creating an impenetrable barrier between them and the doorway through which Dooku had certainly disappeared moments before they had arrived.
Dooku!
Anakin snarled through clenched teeth.
I will kill you!
Control your rage, Anakin, Obi-Wan managed to say between breaths. Don't give him the satisfaction. Anakin shot him a worrisome scowl.
Can't have me becoming too powerful now, can we, Master?
Before Obi-Wan could reply, 20 battle droids hurried into the room through the door behind him. Whirling, he deflected their first barrage, then fought his way to cover behind a heap of dismembered droids where Anakin joined him. In the hope that Dooku was listening from afar, he shouted,
Whatever happens here, Dooku, your Confederacy is finished. The Republic has all of you on the run, even your master, Sidious.
More droids appeared. To Dooku, this was nothing more than a game, Obi-Wan told himself. But if it was a demonstration of force ability Dooku wanted, then Anakin was still more than willing to provide it.
Dooku!
He howled. With such force and wrath that the ceiling of the vast hall began to collapse. Hurry, 3PO, Padme said over her shoulder. Unless you want the Senate to be your final resting place. The protocol droid hastened his pace.
I assure you, Mistress, I'm moving as quickly as my limbs permit. Oh, curse my metal body! I'll become entombed here!
The broad, ornate hallways leading from the Great Rotunda were packed with senators, their aides, staff members, and droids, many laden with armloads of documents and data disks, and in some cases, expensive gifts received from appreciative lobbyists. Padme heard her name called and turned to see Bail Organa and Mon Mothma angling toward where she and C-3PO were momentarily hampered. With them were two female Jedi, Master Shakti and Stassa Lee.
Have you seen the Chancellor?
Bail asked when he could. She shook her head. He's probably in the holding office.
We were just there, Shakti said. The office is empty. Even his guards are gone.
They must have escorted him to the shelters, Padme said.
Bail glanced at something over her shoulder and raised his hand over his head to call attention to himself.
Mas Amida, he explained for Padme's benefit. He'll know where to find the Chancellor.
The tall, horned, gray-complected Chagrian fairly shouldered his way through the crowd.
The Supreme Chancellor has no meeting scheduled until later today, he said in answer to Bail's question. I assume he is in his residence.
500 Republica. Shakti muttered to herself in seeming frustration. I was just there.
Amida gazed down at her in sudden concern.
And the Chancellor wasn't?
I wasn't looking for him then.
The Jedi started to say, then allowed her words to trail off.
Master Ali and I will check the Senate office building and Republica.
She glanced at Padme, Bail, and the others.
Where are you going?
Wherever we're directed to go, Bail said.
The turbo lifts to the shelters are overwhelmed, Stassa Lee said. My skimmer is at the plaza's northwest landing platform. You can pilot that directly to the shelters. Won't you and Shakti need it?
Padme asked.
We'll use the speeder bike I arrived on, Shakti said.
The Jedi led Padme, C-3PO, Bail, and Mon Mothma to the open roof skimmer. The speeder bike was parked alongside. Shakti swung one leg over the seat and started the engine. Stassa Lee settled in behind her.
Good luck, she said.
The senators and the droid watched the two Jedi race off in the direction of the Senate office building. Then, with Bail piloting, they boarded the oval-shaped flash skimmer and dropped down into the wide canyon below the plaza. Free travel traffic was thick even there, but Bail's skill got them through the worst of it and on course for the shelter entrances, which were just below the main sky docks of the Senate Med Center.
Without warning, two beams of scarlet light stabbed at them from somewhere above the dome of the Senate.
Vulture droids, Bail said. Padme clutched onto C-3PO as Bail veered away from the plasma bolts. A flash of intense light blinded Padme momentarily. The skimmer tipped harshly, almost spilling its occupants into midair. Smoke poured from the starboard turbine nacelle, and the small craft went into a shallow dive.
Hold tight! Bail yelled.
We're doomed!
Padme understood that Bail was swerving for a landing platform that abutted a wide sky bridge. Tears streaming from her eyes, stricken with a sudden nausea, she placed her right hand on her abdomen.
Anakin,
she said to herself.
Anakin!
Flagship of the Separatist Flotilla, General Grievous's kilometers-long cruiser, the Invisible Hand, held to a stationary orbit above Coruscant's Senate District. Magnified hollow images of the buildings rose from the tactical table on the cruiser's bridge. Grievous studied the images for a moment before returning to his customary place at the forward view screens. Grievous took a long moment to absorb the silent battle that flared beyond the thick transparasteel of the bridge viewports. He loathed being so far from the action and bloodshed, but he knew that he had to be patient a while longer. Then all the waiting and frustration would be justified. A droid addressed him from one of the duty stations.
General, comm transmissions are returning to normal in sectors of the planet. The enemy appears to have comprehended that we are using the jamming suite we employ to our advantage at Presidlan.
This is not unexpected,
Grievous said.
Instruct Group 1 commanders that they should continue targeting orbital mirrors and communication satellites. Relocate the jamming platform to 010 Ecliptic and intensify the shields.
Yes, General. I am compelled to report that we are sustaining heavy losses in all groups.
Grievous glanced at the tactical table. Group 1 alone had lost 2 Trade Federation carriers. The Nymoidians had managed to jettison the spherical core of one of the carriers, but the other had been blown completely in half. In the hollow field, the tiny dots spilling from the carrier's curved and now separated arms were droid fighters.
Override the survival and engagement programs of those droid fighters. Issue a command that they speed directly for Coruscant. They are to convert to explosive devices.
Are any specific targets assigned?
The outskirts of the Senate District.
General, some of our fighters have already infiltrated that sector.
Excellent. Command those to target landing platforms, skyways, pedestrian plazas, and shelters. Wherever possible, they are to dedicate themselves to overwhelming Coruscant's civil defense forces.
Affirmative.
The adjutant droid had fallen silent, apparently in reception of an update from one of the duty stations. Now, it said.
General, a group of Jedi starfighters has emerged from Coruscant's gravity well.
How large a group?
22 craft.
Deploy as many tri-droids against them as are needed.
Yes, sir.
Grievous turned from the viewports.
Is the strike force assembled?
The droid took a moment to reply.
Your gunboat is ready, and your elites are standing by in the launching bay.
Battle droids as well?
50, General.
Grievous nodded.
That should suffice.
He glanced at the viewport a final time, then turned his gaze on the droid.
Carry on. Consider every Republic vessel a target of opportunity.
Captain Dine stepped cautiously from the platform that had dropped the team into the unexplored depths of 500 Republica. Here, at an intersection of spooky corridors made of permacrete and surfaced with panels of plasteel, no water dripped. No insects constructed hives. No conduit worms nursed on electrical current. Strangely, however, the air was stirred by a faint and fresh breeze. Drawing his Marison blaster from its holster, he hefted it, then thumbed off the stun setting switch. Ahead of him, ghost-like in the dismal light, the commandos were moving toward the thick door at the end of the hall,
keeping close to the walls with weapons raised. Valiant had the point, with the squad's explosives expert close behind, a thermal detonator in hand. Dyne stepped between the powered-down pair of probe droids, TC-16 following in his footsteps. They hadn't advanced 3 meters down the corridor before Dyne's ears pricked up at the sound of gurgled voices. He could sense TC-16 come to a sudden halt behind him.
"Why, someone is speaking Geonosian,"
the protocol droid started to say. Whirling, Dyne found themselves staring down the wide muzzles of two organic-looking sonic weapons grasped in the thick-fingered hands of two Geonosian soldier drones. The next few moments unfurled in silent slow motion. Dyne understood that it wasn't his life flashing before his eyes, but his death. He saw the commandos drop in their tracks as if blown over by a gale force wind. He watched Valiant and the explosives expert leave the floor and hurtle headlong into the door. He observed a storm of probe droid parts whirl past him. He felt himself go airborne and crash into the wall, and his insides turned spongy. He was vaguely aware of being slumped against the wall in a position that didn't come naturally to a human being. It was as if every bone in his body had been made pliant. Soundlessly, the distant door opened inward, and light flooded into the corridor. Still set on slow motion, the immediate world came in and out of focus. What remained of his vision registered a room filled with blinking equipment, screens filled with scrolling data, a hollow projector table, above which drifted a Trade Federation battleship halved and in flames. Two machine intelligences emerged from the room, their slender tubular bodies identifying them as assassin droids. Behind them walked a human of medium height and build who stepped nonchalantly over Valiant's grotesquely twisted body. His liquefying brain notwithstanding, Dyne found a moment to be astonished because he recognized the man instantly. Incredible, he thought. As the Jedi suspected, the Sith had managed to infiltrate the highest levels of the Republic government. The fact that the man had made no attempt to mask himself assured and comforted Dyne that he was about to die. And shortly after the realization, he did. Where is the Chancellor? Shakti demanded of the three Red Guards stationed outside the entrance to Palpatine's suite in 500 Republica. Alongside her hurried Stassa Lee. In their adamant wake followed four members of the building's small army of security personnel, who had escorted the Jedi women from a mid-level skydock to the penthouse level. Despite having been notified of their arrival, the imposing Red Guards kept their force pikes raised in defensive postures. Where? Stassa Lee, making it clear that she was going to get past them one way or another. Shakti had her hand raised to part the doors with a force wave when the guards lowered their pikes and stepped aside. One punched a code into a wall panel, and the pair of burnished doors opened.
This way,
the same guard said, gesturing the Jedi inside. A broad hallway, lined with sculptures and hollow art images, led into the suite itself, which, like Palpatine's chambers in the Senate office building, was predominantly red. There was no telling how large the suite was, but the exterior wall of the vast main room followed the curve of the building's crown and looked down on patchy clouds, typical of those that gathered around the building in late afternoon. Scarcely acknowledging her presence, Palpatine paced into the room like a caged animal, hands clasped behind his back. Additional Red Guards and several of Palpatine's advisors stood watching him, some with comms plugged into their ears, others with devices Shakti understood to be vital to the continued operation of the Republic military. She couldn't help noticing that Pestage and Isard, two of Palpatine's closest advisors, looked nervous. Why is he still here? Stas Ali directed at Isard. Isard made his lips a thin line. Ask him yourself.
Shakti practically had to plant herself in Palpatine's path to get his attention.
Supreme Chancellor, we need to escort you to shelter.
He stopped briefly to regard her, then swung around and paced away from her.
Master T, while I appreciate your concern, I've no need of rescue. As I've made abundantly plain to my advisors and protectors, I feel that my place is here, where I can best communicate with our commanders.
Chancellor, communications will be clearer from the bunker, Pestage said.
Isard added,
All those familiarization drills you so despised were conducted for just this scenario, sir.
Palpatine sent him a skewered grin.
Practice and reality are different matters. The Supreme Chancellor of the Galactic Senate does not hide from enemies of the Republic.
Chancellor, I'm sorry, Stasily chimed in. But the Jedi are obliged to make this decision for you.
Palpatine deployed his signature penetrating gaze. And what will you do should I refuse?
Shakti traded looks with one of the guards. The situation was becoming dangerous.
A shiver born in the Force moved her to glance out the window.
Supreme Chancellor, Pestage was saying, you must listen to reason.
Reason? Palpatine snapped. He aimed a finger toward the window. Have you gazed into our once tranquil skies? Is there anything reasonable about what's occurring there?
All the more reason to move you to safety as quickly as possible, Isard said,
so that you conduct Coruscant's defense from a hardened site.
Palpatine stared at him.
In other words, you agree with the Jedi.
We do, sir, Isard said.
And you?
Palpatine asked the captain of his guards.
The guard nodded.
Then all of you are in error.
Palpatine stormed to the window.
Perhaps you need to take a closer look.
Before a further word could fly from his mouth, Shakti and Stasily were in motion. Shakti tackling Palpatine to the floor, while Ali ignited her blade and brought it vertically in front of her.
Without warning, the gunships closest to 500 Republica were lanced by plasma bolts. Their door gunners blown into midair, the two ships veered and began to fall through the clouds, trailing plumes of fire and thick black smoke.
Unhand me, Palpatine said. How dare you?
Shakti kept him pinned to the floor and caught her lightsaber into her hand.
A shrill sound overrode the window's noise cancellation feature, and a Separatist assault craft rose into view from somewhere below the suite.
Crowded at the side hatches and ready to deploy stood a band of battle droids and others. As the craft hovered closer to the window, Shakti gaped in disbelief.
Grievous! Down!
Stasily shouted a moment before the entire window wall blew inward. Through the shattered window, droids leapt into the room, opening up with blaster rifles. Stasily stood immobile in the rush of wind, noise, and blaster bolts. Six Red Guards raced to her side, their activated force pikes humming in concert with Ali's lightsaber. Droids fell armless, legless, headless before they made it 2 meters into the room. Beaten back, the battle droids broke off their attack. Outside the window, the gunboat was taking heavy fire from a surround of patrol skimmers. As Ali and the Red Guards were felling the final few droids, the Separatist craft dropped back into the clouds with bolts from the skimmers chasing it. Shakti turned to face Izard.
Alert homeworld security that General Grievous has broken through the perimeter.
Elsewhere in the room, Pestage was helping Palpatine to his feet.
Ready now, sir?
Palpatine returned a wide-eyed nod.
These familiarization drills you've been conducting, Stasily started to say.
Izard gestured to one of the side rooms.
The suite is equipped with a secret turbo lift that serves a secure mid-level sky dock. An armored gunship is standing by to transport the Chancellor to a bunker complex in the Sok district.
Negative, Shakti said. Grievous knew enough to come here. We have to assume that the escape route has been compromised as well.
Why not use Republica's private turbo lifts?
One of the security guards suggested.
Ride them to the basement levels and you'll have access to any number of landing platforms.
Stas Aline nodded, then glanced at Palpatine.
Supreme Chancellor, your guards are going to encircle you. You are not to attempt to leave that circle under any circumstances. Do you understand?
Palpatine nodded.
I'll do whatever you say.
Ali waited until the Red Guards had gathered around him.
Now, quickly!
When everyone had moved into the hallway, Shaak-Ti used her comm to find Mace Windu.
Mace, Grievous is on world, she said the moment she heard his voice.
I just heard.
The Chancellor's escape route may be in jeopardy, she continued. We're heading for Republica's sub-basements. Can you meet us there?
Kid and I are nearby.
Pressed into the turbolift with Stasa Lee, Palpatine's guards and advisors, and Republica security personnel, Shaak-Ti watched the display tick off the floors. The turbolift deposited them not far from where she had been earlier, though on the opposite side of the tunnel leading to the east skydock. Just short of entering the tunnel, Shaak-Ti caught a glance of a bright silver protocol droid that might have been TC-16 hastening toward the exit to the west skydock. The tunnel was darker than it should have been at that time of day, and the lower reaches of the canyon were darker still.
Wait here, Shaak-Ti instructed the Red Guards and Palpatine when they had reached the mouth of the tunnel.
Stasily strode to the center of the platform and gazed up at the buildings that loomed to all sides.
Grievous's forces must have destroyed the orbital mirror that feeds this sector.
Shaak-Ti looked straight up at the sliver of sky.
The shield is down. They must have taken out the generator.
Ali indicated the stairway that led to the maglev platform.
The train won't take us to the bunker complex, but close enough.
Shaak-Ti smiled at her and reactivated the comm. Mace, another change in plans.
Dragging himself out from under plasteel girders and chunks of ferrocrete, Count Dooku came shakily to his feet and gazed in astonished disbelief at the shambles of the control room. Had Dooku not leapt forcefully at the last moment, he might have been buried as the two Jedi were, somewhere below in the expanse of rubble that covered the archive room. He was certain that they had survived, but if nothing else, they were trapped, which had been the intent from the start. Outside, under Tarth's yellow-gray sky, his sloop was waiting, and standing alongside it, the ship's pilot droid.
A recorded message,
the droid announced.
From General Grievous.
Play it,
Dooku said as he hurried up the sloop's aft boarding ramp and into the instrument-filled main hold. A paused hollow image of the cyborg floated in blue light. Throwing off his dusty cape, Dooku paced while the FA-4 triggered the recording to replay.
Lord Tyrannis,
Grievous said, in motion suddenly and genuflecting.
Supreme Chancellor Palpatine will soon be ours.
Dooku exhaled in satisfaction.
And just in time, he muttered.
As if recalled to life, he positioned himself on the transmission grid and sent a simple return message.
General, I will join you shortly.
Padme's eyes fluttered open. Into focus swam the faintly smiling face of Mon Mothma.
No sleeping on the job, Senator,
Mon Mothma said, as if from underwater.
We have to get you out of here.
Padme took stock of herself, realized that she was reclined in the rear seat of Stas Ali's skimmer.
How long have...
Just for a moment,
Mon Mothma said, in the same watery tone.
I don't think you struck your head. You were fine after the crash. Then you fainted. Can you move?
Padme sat up and saw that the skimmer's safety mechanisms had deployed. Light-headed but unhurt, she brushed her hair from her face.
I can barely hear you.
Mon Mothma regarded her in knowing silence, then extended a hand to help her climb from the craft.
Padme, you have to be careful. Quickly now!
Mon Mothma hurried her away from the skimmer to where Bail and C-3PO were hiding behind the blockish pedestal of a modernistic sculpture.
Still in a daze, Padme grasped that they had skidded into the plaza that fronted the embassy mall, taking out a large hollow sign and three news kiosks along the way. Reality reasserted itself in a rush of deafening noise, flashing light, and acrid smells. From nearby came anguished moans and terrified screams. From the tiered heights above the plaza, distant discharges of artillery. Higher still, plasma bolts raked the sky. Fire bloomed. Detonations thundered. Padme saw a smear of blood on Bale's cheek.
"You're hurt."
"It's nothing," he said. "Besides, we have more to worry about." She followed his grim gaze and understood immediately why Coruscanti were fleeing the pedestrian skybridge that linked the mall to the mid-level entrances of the Senate Hospital. Five vulture droids had alit on the far side of the span and reconfigured to patrol mode. Republic lats had dropped from the Senate Plaza to engage the 3.5-meter-tall droids, but were maintaining a wary distance just now. Pilots and gunners clearly worried about adding energy weapons or EMP missiles to the chaos. Caught in the crossfire, pedestrians had raced across the skybridge, hoping to find sanctuary in the embassy mall, but thick security grates had been lowered over the entrances, leaving crowds of Coruscanti to scramble for whatever cover could be found.
"Palpatine will never live this down," Mon Mothma was saying, "committing so many of our ships and troopers to the Outer Rim sieges, as if this war he is so intent on winning could never come to Coruscant."
"They're coming." Bale aimed a finger across the plaza.
"They're coming across the bridge."
From somewhere in the vulture's droid brains had come a revelation that the pedestrian skyway offered a better vantage for targeting buildings and craft to both sides of the kilometer-deep canyon. More important, the gunships were even less likely to fire on them there. Bale looked at Padme and Mon Mothma.
"We have to keep those droids on the far side of the bridge so the gunships can take them out."
Mon Mothma glanced at an overturned military craft.
"I see a way to try."
The craft sat scarcely 50 meters from the base of the sculpture. Without further word, the three of them hurried for it. The three humans returned momentarily, carrying three blaster rifles.
"Not much power left," Bale said, checking one of them. "Yours?"
"Low on blaster gas," Padme said.
Mon Mothma ejected the power pack from hers.
"Empty."
Bale nodded glumly. "We'll have to make do." Hunkering down behind the pedestal, he and Padme took careful aim on the closest of the walking droids. By then, three had started onto the skyway, firing at random.
"Be prepared to move as soon as we fire," Bale said.
He indicated one of the kiosks that had survived the crashes of both speeders.
"There's our first cover."
Padme centered the lead droid in the blaster's targeting reticle and squeezed the trigger. Her initial bursts did little more than catch the droid's attention, but subsequent bolts from both blasters started to score hits on vital components. The droid actually retreated a couple of steps toward Hospital Plaza, only to launch a trio of torpedoes straight across the skyway. Padme and company were already in motion. One torpedo hit the pedestal, blowing it and the sculpture to fragments. A second slagged what was left of Stasily's skimmer. The third detonated against the lowered security grate. Converging beams of brilliant light streaked from the fire dishes of the lat's wing and armature-mounted ball turrets, and staccato bursts erupted from the forward guns. Two droids exploded. One turned to answer the volleys, but not in time. Missiles from the gunship's mass drive launchers took off the droid's left legs, then the head, then blew the rest clear across the plaza. The remaining two vultures skittered across the skyway to increase their odds of survival. Bale and Padme laid down steady lines of fire, but the droids were undeterred.
"And I thought the Senate was a battlefield," Mon Mothma said.
The sight of smoke curling from holes in the lead droid's fuselage seemed to invigorate the one behind. Driving Padme and the others in search of new cover with a single torpedo, the droid scurried forward, edging around its stricken comrade and stepping brazenly into the mall plaza, red sensors gleaming. A gunship made a quick pass, but couldn't find a clear field of fire. I'm out, Bale said, dropping his rifle. Padme checked her weapons display screen. Same. C-3PO shook his head.
How will I ever explain this to R2-D2?
They broke for cover a final time, hoping to throw themselves through the ragged hole in the still-smoking security grate. But the droid hurried to intercept them. Then, in seeming sadistic delight, began to back the four of them against the wall of the Nicandra building. A rage began to build in Padme, born of instincts as old as life itself. She was on the verge of hurling herself against the towering machine, ripping the sensors from its teardrop-shaped head, when the droid came to a sudden halt, obviously in reception of some remote communication. Retracting its head and stiffening its scissor-like legs into wings, it turned and launched itself over the edge of the plaza into the canyon below. The droid on the skyway did the same, even with two gunships in close pursuit. Padme was first to reach the skyway railing. Far below, the Senate District Maglev was racing south toward the sky tunnel that would take it through the kilometer-wide Heorim complex and on into the wealthy Sock District. The two vulture droids were swooping down to join ranks with the separatist gunboat that was already chasing the train. How had Grievous known to attack 500 Republica? Mace asked himself as the maglev rushed at 300 kilometers per hour toward the sky tunnel that would spirit the train from the Senate District. Having boarded the maglev at its 500 Republica platform, he, Kit Fisto, Shakti, and Stassa Lee were in the car the Supreme Chancellor's Red Guards had commandeered, second in a train of some 20 cars. Through a gap in the protective circle the guards had forged, Mace caught a glimpse of Palpatine, his head of wavy gray hair lowered in what might have been anguish or deep concentration. The Maglev's other cars were packed cheek to jowl with Coruscanti, attempting to flee the Senate and financial districts. The Maglev line didn't run past the complex, but the first stop in Sock was close to a system of skyways and turbolifts that did. Light filtering into the car through the tinted windows dimmed. The Maglev was entering the Heorim Sky Tunnel, a broad burrow that accommodated not only the speeding train, but also opposing lanes of auto navigation and free travel traffic, passing through several of the Senate District's largest buildings. A blur of light off to the left-hand side of the car caught Mace's eye, and he hurried to the closest window. Streaking southbound in the northbound free travel lane, two droid fighters were trying to overtake the train.
Vulture fighters! Mace told the Jedi and Red Guards.
Leaning low at the window, he saw one of the droids climb over the maglev and disappear from view. Not a moment later, an ear-splitting sound reached Mace from somewhere in the rear of the train and overhead. Behind the tinted glass, sparks showered down the rounded sides of the car, and the smell of molten metal wafted from the ventilation grills. A tumult of terrified cries rose from the car directly behind Palpatine's, and hands and feet began to pound against the passageway door. In turn, Mace whirled to Shakti and Ali. Move the Chancellor into the forward car. Shakti regarded him as if he had lost his mind. It's packed, Mace.
I know that. Find a way.
He gestured for Kit Fisto, and the two of them shouldered through the cluster of security personnel at the rear of the car and activated their lightsabers. Faced with the purple and blue blades, passengers on the far side of the door's window began to retreat into the vestibule. Mace and Kit dashed through the vestibule and on into the rear car, where most of the mixed species passengers were heaped atop seats to both sides of the wide aisle. Wind howled through the car from a jagged rend that had been opened in the roof, and through which had dropped half a dozen infantry droids. Mace allowed himself a moment of bewilderment. Since the battle droids couldn't have been delivered by the droid fighters, there had to be a third separatist craft racing alongside the train. The battle droids opened fire. Together, Mace and Kit returned some of the sizzling bolts into the advancing droids. Others they sent whizzing through the opening in the roof, managing in the process to catch one of the vultures in the belly and send it spiraling to its death somewhere below the maglev line. No sooner had the final droid dropped than Mace leapt straight up through the rend, landing in a crouch on the roof of the next car down the line. Senses on alert, he saw a Separatist craft drop down behind the final car in the line. Farther away, but quickly making up the distance, flew two Republic gunships. Instinctively, he glanced to the right just as the second vulture droid was rocketing into view. Seeing him, the droid sprayed the roof of the car with cannon fire. Mace turned into the powerful wind and focused all his attention on a front flip that carried him back through the rend. The vulture veered, positioning itself directly over the laceration its partner had opened and reorienting its wing cannons. In what would surely have been a futile act, Mace raised his lightsaber. But the expected cannon blast never arrived. Wings clipped and repulsors damaged by missiles fired from the gunships, the vulture slammed down onto the roof of the speeding train, then rolled out of sight. Deactivating their blades, Mace and Kit rushed into the forward car, which was now filled with Palpatine's advisors and those passengers the Jedi women and Red Guards had relocated from the train's lead car. Mace and Kit continued to squirm forward, arriving in the Supreme Chancellor's car just as the maglev was emerging from the sky tunnel. In the middle of the car, Palpatine stood at the center of the cordon the Red Guards had formed around him, and at a fixed-pane window they had deliberately shattered, Shaak-Ti and Stasili were gazing toward the rear of the train. "Those fighters could easily have derailed us with a torpedo," Shaak-Ti said as Mace and Kit approached. Kit's bulging black eyes indicated Palpatine.
"They want to take him alive."
The words had scarcely left his mouth when something hit the train with sufficient force to whip everyone from one side of the car to the other, then back again. The Red Guards were just regaining their balance when the roof began to resound with the cadence of heavy, clanging footfalls advancing from the rear of the train.
"Grievous," Mace grumbled.
Kit glanced at him.
"Here we go again."
Hurrying into the vestibule between the two lead cars, they launched themselves to the roof. Three cars distant marched General Grievous and two of his elite droids, their capes snapping behind them in the wind, pulse-tipped batons angling across their barrel chests. Without pausing, Grievous drew two lightsabers from his belt. By the time they were ignited, Mace was already on and all over the cyborg, batting away at the two blades, swinging low at Grievous's artificial legs, thrusting at his skeletal face. To the rear of the car, where Grievous's pair of elites had made the mistake of pitting themselves against Kit Fisto, the Nautiloid's blade was a cyclone of blazing blue light. In moves a Twi'lek dancer might envy, he spun around the guards, claiming a limb from both with each rotation. Left legs, right arms, right legs. The speed of the train saw to the rest, ultimately whisking the droids into the canyon like insects blown from the windscreen of a speeder bike. The loss of his Confederates was noted by whatever computers were slave to Grievous's organic brain, but the loss neither distracted nor slowed him. Crouching low, Mace angled his blade downward and slashed, guiding it through the roof of the car, perpendicular to Grievous's stalwart advance. Slipping into the gap made by Mace's saber, Grievous's left foot lost magnetic purchase on the roof, and the general faltered. Mace came out of his crouch, prepared to drive his sword into Grievous's guts, but some last-instant firing of the general's cyber-synapses compelled the cyborg's torso through a swift half-twist that would have sent Mace's head hurtling into the canyon had the maneuver prevailed. Instead, Mace leapt backward, out of the range of the slicing blades, and force-pushed outward just at the instant of Grievous's single misstep. Off the side of the car, the general went, twisting and turning as he fell. Mace trying to track the general's contorted plunge, but unsuccessful. Had he fallen into the canyon? Had he managed to dig his Durasteel fingers into the side of the car, or grab hold of the maglev rail itself? Mace couldn't take the time to puzzle it out. 100 meters away, The gunboat retracted its claws and rose from the roof on repulsive power. Reckless shots from one of the pursuing gunships obliged the Separatist craft to skew, then dive, with the gunship following close behind. Mace and Kit watched in awe as the two ships began to helix forward around the speeding maglev, exchanging constant fire. Climbing away from the train's sharp nose, within which the magnetic controls were housed, the gunboat made as if to bank west, only to bank east at the last instant. By then, however, the gunship, leading its target west, had already fired. Drilled by a swarm of deadly hyphens, the maglev's control system blew apart, and the entire train began to drop. In the darkness, buried alive, Anakin stretched out with his feelings. In his mind's eye, he saw Padme stalked by a dark, towering creature with a mechanical head poised at the edge of a deep abyss, her world turned upside down. A surprise attack, opponents locked in combat, ground and sky filled with fire, smoke billowing in the air, clouding everything, death, destruction, deceit, a labyrinth of lies. His world turned upside down. Beside him, Obi-Wan stirred and coughed. "You're getting awfully good at destroying things," he said. "On Vajoon, you needed a grenade to do this much damage." Anakin shook the vision from his mind. "I told you I was becoming more powerful." "Then do us both a favor by getting us out from under all this." They used the Force, their hands and backs, to extricate themselves. Getting to their feet, they stood staring at each other, dusted white head to toe from the debris. "Go ahead," Anakin said. "If you don't say it, I will. If you insist." Obi-Wan snorted dust from his nose. "Almost makes me nostalgic for Naos 3. "Once more, with feeling." "Some other time. Dooku first." Scampering over the remains of the dome, droid parts, buried pieces of furniture, overturned shelves of holodocuments, they raced for the landing platform, arriving in time to see Dooku's sloop, one among dozens of Separatist vessels, streaking for space. "Coward," Obi-Wan said. "He flees." Anakin watched the sloop for a moment longer, then looked at Obi-Wan. "That's not the reason, Master. We've been tricked. Tithe was never the target. We were." Bleeding speed and loft, the maglev settled hard onto the guide rail that projected from the skyscraper-lined rim of Sock Canyon. Counterpoint to the sobs and moans of the passengers. The dozen cars, two now with slashed open roofs, pinged and creaked. Balanced on the balls of their feet, Mace and Kit hooked their lightsabers to their belts and drifted back down into the vestibule as gently as the Force allowed. As if buffeted by thermals, the train swayed lazily from side to side. But with traffic halted in both directions, the air at mid-level should have been unruffled. A quick glance out the right side of the vestibule supplied Mace with the explanation. The aged cantilevered supports anchored to the sides of the buildings were beginning to bend under the weight of the train. Waiting for the train to quiet, Mace and Kit stood like statues in the vestibule. When the rocking motion had subsided somewhat, they pressed the release stud for the passageway door and eased themselves into the lead car. The train continued to protest its peculiar circumstance with an assortment of stressful sounds, but the sagging supports held. Held for a few seconds more. Then, with explosive reports, the rail supports beneath the center of the train tore away from the canyon rim, taking a lengthy portion of the rail with them. The train V'd into the sudden gap and would have plunged completely, but for the fact that enough forward and rear cars remained clasped to the rail to support the few that now formed an inverted triangle. Stepped into Palpatine's car, Mace and Kit called on the Force to prevent everyone from flailing toward the vestibule door. Farther forward in the car, Shaak Ti and Stassa Lee were keeping the Supreme Chancellor on his feet.
Unexpectedly, a feeling of relief flowed through Mace.
The emergency repulsor lifts, Kit said.
Once more, the train lurched, but this time, the cars began to level out as anti-grav repulsors levitated those that had dropped into the notch. By then, too, the pair of repulsor lift platforms had cozied up to the train's left side, and scores of emergency craft were rushing in. Mace could feel an increasing sense of desperation sweep through the cars as passengers grew frantic to exit. He knew that it was only going to get worse, since none of them would be allowed to leave until Palpatine had been moved to safety. He and Kit did their best to make that happen as quickly as possible. Within moments, they had ushered everyone who had been in the lead car onto one of the platforms. Pressed in among his red guards, Palpatine couldn't even be seen. Disengaging from the maglev, the platform was moving away from the train before a single passenger, even any of Palpatine's advisors, could scramble out onto its twin. The air was filled with escort craft and gunships, two of which put down on the platform as it was closing on the canyon's eastern rim. Leaping out of the craft, two platoons of commandos assumed firing positions along the platform's perimeter. Behind them came four Jedi Knights, who rushed to join Shakti and Stassa Lee in guarding Palpatine. Mace recognized the more scorched of the pair of gunships as one of two that had been in pursuit of Grievous's gunboat. Hurrying over to it, he signaled the pilot to raise the bubble canopy. Cupping his hands to his mouth, he said,
"What became of the gunboat?"
"My wingmate is in pursuit, General," the pilot said. "We're awaiting word."
"Did Grievous fall from the maglev?"
"I was too far back to see much of anything, sir. But I didn't see him fall. I didn't see anyone on the train."
Mace clenched his fists and swung to Kit.
"The gunboat could have caught him somehow."
He gazed up at the pilot again.
"Any word yet?"
"Coming in now, sir. Sector H-52. My wingmate is in close pursuit. I'd better get a move on."
"General Fisto and I are going with you."
Mace turned to Shakti, Ali, and the four newly arrived Jedi Knights. Shakti nodded at him. "We'll see the Chancellor the rest of the way to the bunker." Shakti was the last aboard the gunship that would deliver Palpatine to shelter, somewhere deep in the narrow service chasms that fractured the exclusive Sock neighborhood. Encircled by the contingent of Red Guards, Palpatine stood silently in the rear of the troop bay. His hair and robes were mussed, and he looked pale and feeble among his striking protectors. Stassa Lee and the four Jedi Knights Yoda had dispatched from the temple stood just inside the door, shoulder to shoulder with commandos and government agents. Shakti knew the human male Jedi and the female Twi'lek by sight, but she couldn't recall ever running into the other two, a male Talls and a male Ithorian. Moments earlier, the gunship carrying Mace and Kit had banked north, back toward the Senate District, in apparent pursuit of Grievous's gunboat. Palpatine's gunship had taken off to the south and had immediately began to descend. Halfway to the floor of the canyon, a gunship that had seen recent action fell in alongside the Supreme Chancellor's and remained just off to starboard and slightly astern through the numerous twists and turns that led ultimately to the mountainous structure that served as the bunker complex. A final turn to the north brought the two gunships to the mouth of a narrow urban ravine, where they hovered for the moment it took to lower the particle shield that safeguarded the shelters, tactical and communication centers, landing platforms, and the network of tunnels that linked them. Shakti didn't allow herself to relax until the gunships had been cleared through the shimmering screen and had been issued approach vectors for landing. The escort gunship shot ahead and was already on the pad when Shakti and the rest arrived moments later. The craft bearing the Supreme Chancellor had scarcely touched down when the side doors flew out and back and the Red Guards hurried Palpatine off to a waiting speeder. The commandos leapt out to reinforce the bunker's contingent of troopers. Shakti instructed the four Jedi Knights to accompany the Red Guards, promising to join them after she and Stassa Lee had apprised the temple of their safe arrival. The two Jedi women watched the speeder race off into the broad tunnel that accessed the bunker, then swung themselves down to the landing pad.
Ali grabbed her comm and depressed the send button. After several failed attempts to reach the temple, she glanced at Shakti. Too much interference. Let's move away from the ship.
It was the interference that saved them from the explosion that mangled and consumed the gunship. As it was, the blast set their robes on fire and hurled them 10 meters through the air. Retaining consciousness, Shakti used the momentum to propel herself through a tucked roll that carried her almost to the edge of the landing platform. Stasily lay face down nearby. The missile that had destroyed the gunship had been launched by the craft that had preceded them into the ravine. That same craft's several cannons were firing now, laying waste to other vessels and making short work of the troopers. Grievous and six of his elite cut a bloody swath through the broad corridors that led ultimately to Palpatine's sanctuary. Republic soldiers, cloned and otherwise, fell to Grievous's lightsabers and the deadly staffs of his droids. Behind them, the firefight at the landing platform was raging. If nothing else, Grievous told himself, the clash would tie up two of the Jedi and dozens of troopers. Thus far, things were still on target, if not proceeding according to plan. At Palpatine's apartment, Grievous had managed to fool everyone by placing the gunboat on display, then clandestinely transferring himself and his elites into the Republic gunship Lord Tyrannus had promised would be waiting for them. He had been forced to improvise when Palpatine's protectors had opted to follow an alternate route to the bunker, and he had enjoyed chasing the maglev, if not the brief duel on the roof of the train car. Tyrannus had warned him about Mace Windu's prowess with a blade, and now he understood. His literal misstep had shamed him, and he was grateful that the two elite that had fought at his side had not survived to bear witness to it. Had he not managed at the last instant to grab hold of the maglev rail and be retrieved by the borrowed gunship, all the efforts the banking clan had undertaken to have him rebuilt would have been for nothing. Grievous and five remaining elites completed their march to the bunker, deflecting the fire of three troopers guarding the entrance, then decapitating them. Hexagonal, the sturdy portal was impervious to blaster bolts, radiation, or electromagnetic pulse. Grievous was well aware that his lightsabers were capable of burning through the door. While doing so would have heightened the drama of his entry, he did the next best thing. He used the code Tyrannus had provided.
Under no circumstances are you to harm the Chancellor,
he exhorted his elite, while layers of the thick hatch were retracting. The astonishment registered by Palpatine and his quartet of Jedi Knights assured Grievous that he could not have made a more dramatic entry. Posing for effect in the polygonal opening, Grievous granted his opponents a moment to activate their lightsabers, force pikes, and other weapons. Also for effect, he deflected the initial flurry of blaster bolts with his hands before drawing two of his lightsabers. His brazenness summoned the Jedi to him in a flash, but he knew in the first moments of contest that he had nothing to worry about. Compared to Mace Windu, the four were mere novices, whose lightsaber techniques were some of the earliest Grievous had mastered. Grievous enjoyed going against so many Jedi at one time. If time wasn't of the essence, he might have protracted the fight. Feinting with the blade in his right hand, he removed the head of one Jedi with the blade in his left. Distracted when his right foot inadvertently booted the rolling head of his comrade, the Ithorian dropped his guard momentarily and received as penalty a thrust to the heart that dropped him to his knees before he pitched forward. Stepping back to absorb what had happened, the two remaining Jedi came at Grievous in concert, twirling and leaping about as if putting on some sort of crowd-pleasing martial arts demonstration. For practice, Grievous called two more blades from his belt, grasping them in his feet, even as the anti-grav repulsors built into his legs were lifting him from the floor, making him every bit as agile as the Force did the Jedi. With his four blades to the Jedi's two, the duel had come full circle.
whirling, he severed the blade hand of the Tals, then his opposing foot, then took his life as well. The fourth, he intimidated into retreat by wheeling all four blades, transforming himself into a veritable chopping machine. Fear blossomed in the Twi'lek Jedi's dark eyes as she backed away. Best to put the Jedi out of her misery, Grievous thought, which he did with a single blade to the heart, for it would have been cruel to do otherwise. Then, deactivating his lightsabers, he turned to Palpatine.
Now, Chancellor, you're coming with us.
Dooku hadn't fled alone. The only indications of Tithe's invasion were the hulking remains of Separatist and Republic warships tumbling indolently in starlight.
We were all beginning to wonder if you were going to return, a human crew chief said by way of welcoming Obi-Wan and Anakin back to the assault cruiser's ventral landing bay.
Obi-Wan descended the ladder affixed to the starfighter's cockpit.
When did the Separatists jump?
Less than an hour, local. Guess they'd had enough of the pounding we were giving them. Leaping to the deck, Anakin laughed nastily.
Believe whatever you want.
The crew chief furrowed his brow in uncertainty.
Do we know where they're headed?
Obi-Wan asked quickly.
The crew chief turned to him.
Most of the capital ships jumped rimward. A few appear to be headed for the Kubi system, 13 parsecs from here.
What are our orders?
We're still waiting to find out. The fact is, we haven't received any communications from Coruscant since the start of the battle.
Anakin took a sudden interest in the crew chief's remarks.
Could be local interference, Obi-Wan said. The crew chief looked dubious.
Several other battle groups reported that they had been unable to communicate with Coruscant.
Anakin shot Obi-Wan an embittered look and began to storm away.
Anakin, Obi-Wan said, following in his footsteps.
Anakin whirled on him.
We were wrong to come here, Master. I was wrong to come here. It was all a feint, and we fell for it. We're being kept away from Coruscant. I can feel it.
Obi-Wan folded his arms across his chest.
You wouldn't be saying that if we'd captured Dooku.
But we didn't, Master. That's what counts. And now, no communication with Coruscant? You don't even see it, do you?
Obi-Wan regarded him carefully. He had his mouth open to speak when the crew chief interrupted.
General Skywalker, something has your astromech very flustered.
Obi-Wan and Anakin swung to Anakin's starfighter.
R2?
Anakin said in a concerned tone. The astromech tooted, shrilled, chittered. Anakin began to scale the cockpit ladder.
What is it, R2? What's wrong?
Throwing himself into the open cockpit, Anakin toggled switches. Obi-Wan had just reached the base of the ladder when he heard Palpatine's voice issuing through the cockpit annunciators.
Anakin, if you are receiving this message, then I have urgent need of your help.
The crew chief's comm link toned. Obi-Wan glanced from the crew chief to Anakin and back again.
What is it?
He asked in a rush.
Tide beam comm from Coruscant, the crew chief said.
He listened for another moment, then added in obvious disbelief.
Sir, the Separatists have invaded.
Grievous had a good lead on them. Seated in the co-pilot seat of a Republic cruiser, Mace accepted that the shuttle couldn't be intercepted before it left Coruscant's envelope, and perhaps not before it was in the protective embrace of the Separatist fleet. Regardless, the hot, scrambled starfighters were giving all they had to the chase. Calling full power from the cruiser, Kit Fisto joined the three Jedi starfighters in a flat-out race for the shuttle. By then, too, several Republic frigates and corvettes were diverting from the principal battle to assist in the interception. Despite his earlier misgivings, Mace thought for a moment that they might succeed. Then he watched in disquiet as 500 droid fighters, gushing from the great curving arms of a Trade Federation battleship, swarmed forward to safeguard the shuttle in its flight to freedom.
slapped by fire, the tri-winged shuttle fairly crawled toward the docking bay of the cruiser. Grievous held to his treacherous course, even while contingency plans formed in his mind. Wings of Trade Federation droid fighters had burned a path for the shuttle through arms of intense combat, but the vulnerable little ship was not yet in the clear. Many of Grievous's impassioned pursuers were so busy defending themselves that they no longer represented a threat. But three starfighters had managed to stay with the shuttle and were continuing to harry it with surgical fire. The mechanical voice of a control droid aboard the cruiser issued from the shuttle's cockpit speakers.
General, do you wish us to deploy tri-droids against the starfighters?
Negative, Grievous said. Save them for when we actually need them. Ready the forward tractor beam. Fire a disabling burst at all four of us. Then utilize the beam to ensnare what remains of the shuttle and draw it into the docking bay. Even if that means dragging a starfighter in as well. Have battle droids standing by.
Yes, General.
Grievous swiveled his seat toward Palpatine, who was strapped into an acceleration couch between two of the elite guards.
Strap in, Chancellor. This could get rough.
Palpatine sneered. With you at the controls, I'm certain it will. No sooner did Grievous swing back to the viewport than gouts of fire spewed from the cruiser's forward cannons. Two of the starfighter pilots must have sensed something coming because they all but glued themselves to the shuttle. Rocked by the burst, the shuttle lost portions of itself to space and all systems shut down. One of the starfighters was blown away, but the other two had lost little more than their wings. The shuttle reeled as the tractor beam took hold of it. With it came the pair of starfighters. The three were scarcely through the docking bay's containment field when explosive charges flung the canopies from the starfighters and two Jedi Knights leapt to the deck, lightsabers ablaze, deflecting blaster bolts from battle droids as they raced for the shuttle. Before the shuttle had even settled to the deck, one of the Jedi had plunged his glowing blue blade straight through the starboard hatch. Hurrying aft through thickening smoke, Grievous caught sight of Palpatine's expression of derision.
Surprise, surprise, General.
Grievous halted just long enough to say,
We'll see who's surprised.
Grievous saw the lightsaber blade retract. By the time he had shouldered through the hatch onto the landing platform, the Jedi had moved to either side. Even while continuing to parry blaster bolts, they surged at him, engaging the two lightsabers he drew from his cloak. The duel raged through the hold. Battle droids lowered their weapons for fear of hitting Grievous. These Jedi were more proficient than the ones he had fought in the bunker, but not skilled enough to challenge him. Flanking him, the Jedi rushed in. Grievous waited until the last instant to command his legs to raise him up several centimeters. Then he extended his lightsaber straight out from his sides, angling slightly downward. Slipping past the flashing strikes of his opponents, Grievous's blades pierced the chests of both. They fell away from him, faces contorted in surprise, of the sort only sudden death could bring. Several battle droids hastened forward, almost prancing in eagerness.
Jettison the bodies,
Grievous instructed.
Choose a place where the Republic can have a good look at them.
Diminutive between two elite droids, Palpatine was waiting at the foot of the shuttle boarding ramp.
Take him.
Lifting Palpatine by his armpits, the droids followed Grievous through the cruiser, and at last through an oval of opalescent portal into a large cabin space containing a situation table surrounded by chairs. Grievous ordered the guards to set the Supreme Chancellor down in a chair at the head of the table, facing a length of curved bulkhead, and to shackle his hands.
Welcome to the General's quarters,
he said, while he did input at a console built into the table. Shortly, the curved wall became a hologramic display, showing the Battle of Coruscant. The flick of a final switch summoned a stalked eyeball-shaped holocam from the tabletop.
You're about to make an unscheduled appearance on the holonet, Chancellor. I apologize for not providing a mirror, hairbrush, and cosmetics, so that you might at least camouflage some of your fear.
Palpatine's voice was sinister when he spoke.
You can display me, but I won't speak.
Grievous nodded at what seemed an obvious statement.
I'll display you, but you won't speak. Is that understood?
You will do all the talking.
That's correct. I will do all the talking.
Very good.
For no apparent reason, Grievous felt uncertain.
Lord Tyrannus will soon be here to take charge of you.
Palpatine smiled without showing his teeth.
Then I am assured of being greatly entertained.
From aboard his cruiser, General Grievous addressed a captive audience of trillions of beings. His frightening visage dominating every frequency of the holonet, he delivered a message of gloom and doom, forecasting the end of Palpatine's reign, the long-delinquent downfall of the corrupt Republic, a bright new future for all the worlds and all the species that had been enslaved to it. Crushed in among the Chandra Plaza's suddenly silent multitude, Bail touched Mon Mothma's arm in a gesture that promised his imminent return, and began to writhe his way to the edge of the crowd. Gazing around, he spied Padme standing with C-3PO, arms cradled against her, elbows in the palms of her hands, her face raised to the light-splintered sky. Hastening to her, he called her name, and she turned from the handrail into his comforting embrace, her tears wetting the front of his tunic.
"Padme, listen to me," he said, stroking her hair. "The Separatists have nothing to gain by killing Palpatine. He'll be all right."
"What if you're wrong, Bail? What if they do kill him, and power falls into the hands of Masa Mita and the rest of that gang? That doesn't worry you? What if Alderaan is next on Grievous's list of worlds to attack?"
"Of course it worries me. I fear for Alderaan, but I have faith that won't happen. This attack will put an end to the Outer Rim sieges. The Jedi will be back where they belong, here in the core. And as for Masa Mida, he won't last a week. There are thousands of senators who think as we do, Padme. We'll rally them into a force to be reckoned with. We'll put the Republic back on course, even if we have to fight tooth and nail to overcome anyone who opposes us."
He put his hand under her chin to lift her face toward his.
"We'll get through this, no matter what."
She sniffled, smiled lightly. "If I could keep my concerns focused only on the future of the Republic."
Bail held her gaze and nodded in understanding. "Padme, if it's any comfort to you, please know that my wife and I would do anything to protect you and those close to you."
"Thank you, Bail," she said. "With all my heart, thank you."
In his quarters in the temple, Yoda watched a holonet feed that showed the bodies of two Jedi drifting in space. The corners of his mouth pulled down in sadness. He turned to the comlink.
"See them, I do."
Mace's voice rumbled from the speaker.
"If we can ever break through this fighter screen, we'll storm the cruiser."
"Kill the Supreme Chancellor. Grievous will."
"I don't think so. He's had plenty of chances already."
"Wait then to hear the Separatist demands we should."
"The Senate will give away Coruscant to effect Palpatine's release."
"Worse the situation will be if the Supreme Chancellor dies. Fall the Republic will."
Mace fell silent for a moment. Yoda saw him in the cockpit of the cruiser he and Kit had piloted off Coruscant.
"What should we do?"
"To the Force. Look for guidance. Accept what fate has placed before us. For now, prevent Grievous's fleet from escaping to hyperspace, you must. Recalled, many Jedi and others have been. Turn the battle wheel when they arrive."
"Master Yoda, we were close to capturing Sidious. I could feel it.
Knew this Sidious did. Hiding he is.
No longer on Coruscant, Yoda thought.
We'll pin Grievous here like the vermin he is.
Mace severed the transmission, and Yoda tottered to the windows. Western Coruscant was engulfed by darkness, the sky above splintered by rabid light.
Perilous the future will be, a cause for grave concern. But the battle in local space wasn't the end. Beginning, the final act was.
Dooku had ordered the droid pilot of the sloop to revert from hyperspace for a brief time at the planet Kubi. Should any ships among the Republic battle group at Tithe plot his escape course, it would appear that Kubi was his destination. The sloop's Geonosian technology would mask the fact that he had jumped almost immediately to Coruscant to join Grievous and to play out the final act of the drama Sidious had composed. The abduction of Palpatine had not only abbreviated the search for him, but also allowed Sidious to escape Coruscant undetected. But those events had been minor acts. Sidious would never have allowed the Jedi to expose him, and Palpatine was hardly the prize he appeared to be. The greater prize, Sidious had told Dooku during their most recent communication, was Anakin Skywalker.
Long have you watched him, Dooku had said, repeating words Sidious himself has spoken.
Longer than you know, Lord Tyrannus. Longer than you know. And the time has come to test him again.
His skills, my lord.
The depth of his anger. His willingness to go beyond the Force as the Jedi know it, and to call on the power of the dark side. General Grievous will activate a special beacon that will call Skywalker and Kenobi back to Coruscant, and onto the stage we will set for them.
But not to capture them.
You will duel them. Kill Kenobi. His only purpose is to die, and in so doing, ignite young Skywalker to tap the depths of his fear and rage. Should you defeat Skywalker easily, then we will know that he is not prepared to serve us. Perhaps he never will be prepared. Should he by some fluke best you, however, I will control the outcome to spare you any unnecessary embarrassment, and we will have gained a powerful ally. But above all, you must make the contest appear real, Lord Tyrannus.
I will treat it as if it were my crowning achievement, Dooku had promised.
The two starfighters sat side by side in the launching bay, only a few meters separating them. Engines warming, droids in their sockets, cockpit canopies raised. Neither pilot wore a helmet, so Anakin could hear Obi-Wan plainly when he shouted, "For all the jinks and jukes you've taken me through, there's no one else I'd rather fly with." Anakin canted his head and smiled. "It's about time you admitted it. Can I take that to mean you'll follow my lead without question?" "To the best of my ability," Obi-Wan said. "I may not always be able to remain at your wing, but I won't be far off, and I'll always have your back. When I call for help, you come speeding to the rescue. The day you call for help, I'll know we're both in over our heads." Anakin adopted a serious look. "Obi-Wan, you don't know how many times you've already rescued me." Obi-Wan swallowed the lump that formed in his throat. "Then whatever lies ahead for us shouldn't be a problem." Anakin laughed lightly. "Who'll restore peace to the galaxy if we don't?" Obi-Wan returned a tight-lipped nod. "At least you said we." They lowered the starfighter's canopies and engaged the repulsors, lifting off, rotating 180 degrees, and easing through the launching bay's transparent containment field. Flying abreast, all but sharing a wing, they enabled their thrusters and banked away from the massive ship, accelerating on columns of brilliant blue energy, slewing slightly to port, slightly sinister. They coupled with their hyperdrive rings and disappeared into the long night.
This is Jonathan Davis. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Star Wars: Labyrinth of Evil by James Luceno. This program was produced, directed, and abridged by Kevin Thompson. Executive producer, Jacob Bronstein. Star Wars: Labyrinth of Evil is a production of Lucasfilm Limited, copyright 2005. All rights reserved, used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music Master Production Copyright 2005, Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Random House audio presentation. All rights reserved.